supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. Well, the show's about faster and faster. Well, I recently returned from a 5-day silent meditation retreat. Predictably, those first 36 hours were very difficult. My anxiety is up. I'm uncomfortable inside my skin. I get somatic symptoms, and I try to turn them into something that will give me a ticket to run out of there and go home. It happens almost every time, and I know why it happens. I think it's actually a kind of psychological and physiological withdrawal. As I disentangle from my fast-paced, computer-driven life, my body-mind is bound to have a strong reaction. And all of this raises important questions. Am I, or we, in some way, shape, or form, addicted or habituated to the lives we have? Even if they're stressful, even if they're unpleasant, are we habituated to them? And what about our children who are using computers almost before they can talk? Children who've been playing video games since ages 3 or 4 years old and whose lives are consumed by screens. What's happening to their brains? More important, what can we do about it to care for our children and care for ourselves? We'll speak with Drs. Stephanie Brown and Michael Rich. Stephanie Brown is an addiction therapist. She directs the Addictions Institute in Silicon Valley and studying addiction behavior for 35 years. She's written Speed, Facing Our Addictions to Faster and Faster and Overcoming Our Fear of Slowing Down. Stephanie, welcome to Voices.
Thank you.
Dr. Michael Rich is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School. He's an associate professor of society, human development, and health at Harvard School of Public Health. And his current areas of health research and clinical work bring together his experience and expertise in medicine and media. And he's been monikered his moniker is the world's first mediatrician. Michael, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
I'd love to see what your business card looks like. With all
it's in large print and small words for small people.
Stephanie, let's start with you. And by the way, we'll be taking calls a little bit later in the show, but why don't you call in now, because I have a feeling our phones are going to be backed up. Our number is 888-477-9499. That's 888-477-9499. Stephanie, your book came across our desk, and it was really, the title was the impetus for today's show. You live in Silicon Valley, which, you know, it's got a reputation for being laid back, California, but it's a mecca of speed and technology. What are you seeing coming into your practice?
Well, I see speed all around, and I have for many, many decades. And the way you just described it, it's part of the paradox. Paradox is just so much a part of our lives, the way we think, and definitely a core of addiction.
Well, you know, historically, we've always rushed to achieve, to keep up with our neighbors, to keep up with trends in society. So what got you thinking that this is an addiction?
Well, living in the heart of the development of computers, technology, the development of venture capitalism, business model, and, you know, really our society has turned into a business model culture, I believe. So maybe 20 years ago, I'm already a specialist in addiction. I'm a psychologist practicing writing, theorizing about addiction, and here I am in the midst of feeling like I have landed in an alcoholic family, that people are becoming out of control. They're dominated by impulse, by repeated beginning robotic action, and they are adjusting their thinking to rationalize, explain why they need to be this out of control, why it's important, so that loss of control has become embedded in our definitions of success.
Michael, it does seem, you know, I talked about what we've done historically, but it really does seem that everything is going faster and faster. I know you specialize in the impact of digital media, but the pace of life really is terribly stressful these days, and that's a safe generalization. There's lots of research on that. But what does this kind of speed that Stephanie's describing, what does that do to the brain?
Well, it increases all of our anxiety. If you think about it, anxiety is essentially a normal and natural stress response without a real precipitant, a real trigger for that stress response. And, you know, we need that stress response when we are threatened in one way or another, or we need to perform in one way or another. But what has happened is that we have made choices or not made choices to avoid situations that place us in a constant state of stress. If you think about it, you know, a decade even ago, certainly, you know, two decades ago, only doctors were on call 24/7. And now we all are, and we have set up a situation for ourselves in which we feel that we need to be available at all times and instantaneously in terms of our responses to virtually anyone out there, including spam.
Yeah, I remember I this goes back many years, I called a hospital, and I needed a psychiatric hospital. I needed to talk to their marketing director about getting someone for the show. And her voice message says, you know, I'm away from my desk, so on and so forth. She said, but if it's an emergency, I can be reached on my cell phone at, and I'm thinking, what the hell is a marketing emergency? You know, it's you know, with all due respect to the marketing people, you know, nobody's nicked an artery here. But, but you know, that's our mindset these days. And, you know, Michael, I feel a little defensive when I listen to you. You say we have made choices or not made choices. I mean, there's really this cultural juggernaut that seems to be carrying us.
Right, but, you know, ultimately, this is all about taking control of one's own experience, one's own existence. And it's very easy to point fingers at, you know, it's Silicon Valley and what they create, or, you know, it's Microsoft.
Or it's our mothers,
of course, yeah. But to quote the great philosopher Pogo, we have met the enemy and he is us.
Right.
We have made these choices, or as I say, not made the choices to step away from this. And what the Center on Media and Child Health that I direct at Boston Children's Hospital is about is moving past the values-laden arguments of the past of TV bad for you, First Amendment rights to freedom of expression, stay off my MTV, into an evidence-based response to how we are going to integrate these technologies, which can do great good for us, into a human and humane lifestyle that allows us to become the people we want to be and live the lives we want to live.
Stephanie, you made an argument, I think, in your book that to address these big questions that Michael just talked about, who do we want to be as humans? Who do we want to be as parents? What do we want our children to be as adults in terms of their own welfare and contribution? These big questions, they require space to reflect.
Oh, Absolutely. Absolutely. First, I just want to say to Michael, what a great statement you just made about what we need and where we are in the culture. Absolutely. And to me, the first step is becoming aware. We go so fast, we are dominated by impulse and behavior, that we are no longer stopping to think, what am I doing? To ask ourselves, what am I doing? And so we need to become aware, step back, begin to reflect.
Well,
wait a minute. I am being swept up and swept away, and I like this ride.
Well, I would challenge that. Now, you're seeing a different population because you're working with addicts, and you know, and Michael, you might challenge it also, but here's why, Stephanie. I give talks to high school kids all over the country, and you know, I talk with them, not at them, and I ask, you know, how many of you feel stress, and all hands go up, and we begin to talk about details about what's causing the stress, and you know, we just hang out for an hour and 90 minutes, and almost all of them know that it's not good for them. Almost all of them know it doesn't feel good. So, you know, they are aware, but what now? Because the risks of doing things different feel like they're sky high. So where do you go with that? And you know what? They are. There's more competition out there for these kids to get the good grades, to get into college, to get the scholarship, because so many can't afford to go to college, and to get the right job, and on and on. I mean, life itself is stressful. And I've learned what I'm saying to you from kids who say to me, if I stand up and do something different now, I could be risking my whole future.
Well, you know, I agree with you, and I want to just invoke again paradox, because when I say become aware, I'm talking about taking that sensibility that you're describing, and I see it too. People are scared. They're unhappy at all ages. The young people out here, you know, are full of stress disorders. But that awareness needs to translate throughout our culture to a sense of that hitting bottom, that sense, I can't do this anymore. Kids cannot lead the way. It is so difficult. But one small step at a time in our culture, these kinds of conversations,
yeah,
it needs to become possible to make a choice to, you know, hang up, turn off for small amounts of time.
Michael, before I want to have Michael weigh in on that statement, but let me reintroduce both of you. We're talking about speed and what it does to us, not the chemical speed, although we might be talking about the chemical of speed in our brains, whether it's cortisol or
dopamine
or dopamine and adrenaline, and I'm sure it's a whole cocktail of things that feel good. We're talking with Michael Rich, who's a mediatrician. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard, and he's also got a master's in public health, so he's an associate professor of society, human development, and health also at Harvard. Stephanie Brown is an addiction specialist who's written Speed, Facing Our Addictions to Faster and Faster. If you want to join our conversation, the number is 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. Michael, let me just ask you to weigh in on what Stephanie said about what we can, should do as a family, as a culture.
Well, all of the research that we have done and we have collected and put together, actually, and made available to everyone for their perusal of it, has indicated the fact that we are moving faster and faster, largely because we have shifted from a proactive to a reactive stance mm-hmm. in virtually everything we do. We are reacting to the vibrate of the phone in our pocket or to the email coming up or to the phone ringing. And when it was just a landline telephone, that was fine. The problem is that we have multiple screens, multiple devices beckoning us. And a lot of it is not important stuff, but we're not initiating these movements. We are responding to. You can lose an entire day just responding to email or, you know, add social media and your mobile phone, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the first thing we need to do is take a step back and examine our lives and say, is this what we want to do? Do we want to spend our days reacting to every email from Sears? Or do we want to push our lives forward and be proactive about it and go for what we want? And the way to do that is to be mm-hmm. mindful about the tools that we're using, to recognize that these are tools, that these are not parts of ourselves. These are not important entities that we can't live without, but they are a shovel, they are a saw, they are a hammer, and you use them for the jobs they do well, and you turn them off and don't use them when they don't do the job well.
There might be another layer here also, apropos of what Stephanie's talking about. The late neuroscientist Candace Pert suggested that her research was leading her in the direction of feeling that we actually become addicted or habituated to our predominant emotion. And thus, you know, we could become certainly addicted to dopamine, but we could become, she's suggesting, addicted to adrenaline or cortisol or whatever the concomitant brain chemical is for depression or cynicism.
I think that is correct for a subset of people. I think for most people, it's not truly addiction, but it's just compulsion. And I think it's important to draw a distinction between those two, in the sense that addiction really is uncontrollable on the part of the person. With many of us, it really is a choice, but it's an inactive one. And, you know, I often say with the way that we are focused on our mobile phones in particular and our instantaneous response to it, you'd think we were all carrying the nuclear launch codes. You know, there's ultimately something very narcissistic about the sense that somehow we have to respond to that text right now.
Yeah, you're right. That is nuclear launch codes. I can't even remember my phone number half the time.
All right, you don't have to.
Yeah, that's the problem. My smartphone made me stupid.
Right.
We're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to listen to some callers and their take on this. Our need for speed, our fast-paced life, what it's doing to our brains, what it's doing to our children's brains, and I'm going to ask both my guests what we can do about it. We're talking with Dr. Michael Rich. He's an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard and an associate professor of society, human development, and health also at Harvard. Stephanie Brown is an addiction specialist who's written the book Speed, Facing Our Addiction to Faster and Faster. If you'd like to join our conversation, we're at 888-477-9499. Again, that's 888-477-9499. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcomes clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bala Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and weight management. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020. Beck Institute proudly supports WHYY.
Devereaux is a proud supporter of WHYY. For more than 100 years, Devereaux has provided care to individuals with developmental disabilities and mental and behavioral health disorders. Devereaux's work also includes its full continuum of autism-specific programming for individuals of all ages, including residential services, community-based group homes, employment training, and support and educational programs. For more information on Devereaux's autism-specific services, devereaux.org.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about faster and faster, our need for speed and the impact of what's happening in our digital media on our lives, on our brains, and on our mind with Drs. Stephanie Brown and Michael Rich. Let's go right to the phones. We've got Nina on the line. Hi, Nina.
Hi, Dan. Hi, Dan and Michael. Hi. I'm a hospice nurse. Hello?
Yes. Stephanie just
I'm
said
sorry.
Hi.
Yes, hi. I've been a hospice nurse for a long time, and our team, we were talking about how crazy it is how we now, we remove remote controls. This sounds a bit morbid and weird, but one of the last things we do is remove remote controls from the hands of especially men who are dying. It's just, I know it sounds morbid, but it's pretty funny and kind of strange, but it's just an odd thing that it almost seems like a comfort to them. Who knows?
Yeah, well, it certainly is a comfort, and men are men, you know. But
that's no excuse.
But exactly. But I do want to say this, you know, for people who feel out of control, and the dying certainly feel out of control, we like to hold on. We like to hold on to whatever we can control.
And I think also, you know, this is about maintaining connection and reaching out to something which is actually low effort on the user's part. It is much harder to have a conversation with someone in real life than it is to watch a television show where people are having a conversation. So I think that it is a comfort, and it is a reaching out for connection to the world and control over something, as you mentioned.
Well, that raises a question. You talk about connection. I wonder if that's why we're so afraid to miss calls or texts. Are we afraid of being disconnected? Disconnected,
yeah.
You know, means dying literally in a literal sense.
Right. And it's not just that we're afraid of being disconnected, but the sender of that message is awaiting our response. I've actually had patients who've said that if I don't text back within the next 2 or 3 minutes, my friends wonder if I don't like them anymore, or my girlfriend thinks I'm, you know, seeing someone else, or whatever.
Oy vey.
Right. That really reflects the sense that everything has to be instant, and that reinforces the dominance of impulse. That feeling of being out of control. And I want to speak to the caller about comfort. Now, we are all, I think, in agreement that technology is wondrous and that it's mixed, and we don't yet know the point of integration where we can make the very best use of it, but not sacrifice through choice or through robotic, automatic behaviors. Sacrifice our choice, sacrifice our humanity. I am now saying is that there's a big difference between human relational connection and one contact after another. And I think we are very much confusing contact and connection.
Well,
connection takes time.
That's the missing piece, isn't it, Michael? And I'll turn to you, that we are constantly reaching out, trying to scratch an itch that doesn't get satisfied through digital media.
Well, I think this is an example of us trading, you know, quality for quantity in a lot of different ways. I mean, I think that when friend became a verb instead of a noun, it changed the meaning of the word. It became something that you collected more of rather than committed more into. And I think that we have to look at the quality of our relationships. And one of the things that I often recommend to my patients, actually, is when they are seeking to reach out to someone, think about upgrading by one in terms of intimacy. Intimacy is scary. We avoid intimacy. We back off from it. And that's why we tweet people instead of talking to them. So if you're thinking of tweeting someone, text them. If you're thinking of texting, call them. If you're thinking of calling, get together with them. And upgrade the quality of that relationship, but increasing the level of risk to you. But this is how we get truly connected and truly committed to each other.
You know, it's funny, you talk about paradoxes. As I listen to you, Michael, I'm thinking about intimacy, and really the only way to be truly intimate is to allow yourself to be vulnerable, is to literally, you know, literally, but open your heart to other. But, you know, these things don't protect us from being vulnerable, digital media. It doesn't protect us from being vulnerable because everybody feels so much more at risk for being hurt through digital media.
I disagree. I think people actually feel safer on digital media than they do in real life. It is much easier to tell your girlfriend you're breaking up with her on Facebook than it is to say to it to her face. It is much easier to fire someone by text than it is to call them into your office. And I think that many of the problems that people get into where they actually get hurt in the digital space is not because they are more vulnerable, but because they are unaware of their vulnerability and they feel invulnerable and they're sexting or cyberbullying, et cetera.
Well, speaking of sexting, we had a caller that said that pornography is the elephant in the room. Talk about intimacy issues, you know, and that's a multi-billion-dollar business these days.
It built the internet, just like it built VCRs before it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, this is the economic engine behind the internet. It was pornography. Billions of dollars are in it because it is a safer space to do that which everybody wants to do but doesn't want to be seen doing.
Let's go on, Stephanie.
I agree with that about pornography, but I would like to say I think there's a herd of elephants in the room.
I agree with that.
We should not be reducing in any way at this point in our conversation the scale and the scope of what's entailed and covered by this rampant, to me, out of control cultural dominance of behavior and impulse.
Let's go back to the phones. We've got Dave on the line. Hi, Dave.
Yes. How are you today?
Good, thanks.
I was just good. Well, I was listening to both of the guests, and the thing that I find that's funny, we take our society and we program our society to many, many things, and then when it produces side effects, things that are good for us, then we try to find a way to undo it without thinking about what we're doing and put our society in that risk. And all this stuff with the technology is great, but the problem is our kids are constantly bombarded by, you have to have this, you got to have that to be on top of things, you got to stay ahead of things. And this is the reason why we're going through all this, because we get programmed to do it, and then you get people coming and saying, well, oh, why are our kids doing this? We've all been programmed to do this, and that's the problem. It's a paradox. If we're going to have this, there's got to be a mechanism create it so people can, you know, understand that, you know, this is not the tell-all or the do-all of all things. And once we realize that, we won't have these problems.
I think that's a really important point, and I appreciate your calling in. The other factor is, these days, kids need computers. You know, schools are all about computers now. Homework is being given out via email. They need computer programs in order to do a lot of their homework. They email it back in. So, you know, Michael, you know, it can't be black or white here.
It's not black or white, and our tendency to blame the devices is what gets us in trouble. The devices mm-hmm. are neutral. It's what we do with them that gives them their positive or negative valence. Computers, televisions, mobile phones are phenomenal tools that can do great things. The problem is that we have started using them mindlessly, or from the beginning we've been using them mindlessly. Your caller mentioned, why are the kids doing this? The kids are doing this because their parents are doing this. Kids hear about 1% of what their parents say, but they hear 100% of what their parents do. And if they see dad saying, turn off the TV, and dad's doing the crackberry prayer, you know, it doesn't land, because they're sitting there saying, this is the person that I want to emulate. This is the person I want to grow up into, and this is what he's doing. Therefore, I must do this as well.
Did you actually say crackberry prayer just now?
Doing the crackberry prayer. Absolutely.
I will quote you on that. That's the highlight of my day.
Well, if you think about it, it looks like people praying, doesn't it?
Yeah, it really does. It really does. So let's get to the what can we do about this. Michael, you've said that one of the single most protective things we can do is to build in a daily sit-down dinner with the family. No screen time.
Right. So absolutely. One of the things
research.
That we see time and again in public health research, first of all, it was looked at for reasons of nutrition. But what we found is that a host of particularly psychological well-being issues are supported by at least one meal a day with the family around the table and screens off. One of the interesting things is that over 50% of American households eat with a screen on. When the screen is on, all of those beneficial effects disappear.
Sure, sure. I mean, go into a restaurant where there's the TV on. Where are your eyes going to go?
Right.
I also wonder how many families actually do have a family meal together. Any research on that you're aware of, Michael?
I'd have to go and look for it. And I have not looked at it that way. What we tend to look at is the difference between those families that do and those families that don't.
I vaguely recall years ago I read a study. I think it could have been Big Brothers, Big Sisters study. I'm not quite sure. But they showed that families who had dinners together three times a week, the kids spoke at earlier ages. They got better grades in school. They were less likely to use drugs and alcohol or drop out of school. I mean, the results were astounding.
Right, right. And what is one of the things that suffers first with our hyper-busy, overscheduled lives? A family meal.
Right, or good food.
Right, absolutely, good food. But even, you know, fitting the family schedule together so everybody can sit down at the same time in the same place.
Yeah, that's got to be underscored. Before we take our break, I want to underline that again. Family meals are the most important thing we can do for our children. So saying that, we will come back after a short break. We're talking about our addictions to faster and faster and the impact of digital technology. When we come back, we're going to talk about what we can do about it as individuals and as parents. We're talking about with psychologist Stephanie Brown and psychiatrist Dr. Michael Rich. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
Alzheimer's disease is the sixth leading cause of death in the U.S. Alzheimer's is not curable, but prescription medications can sometimes help to maintain the quality of life for longer periods. Keystone Clinical Studies of Norristown is conducting a research study to test a new investigational medication for patients with a diagnosis of mild to moderate Alzheimer's disease. 610-277-8073. 610-277-8073 or keystoneclinicalstudies.com. Keystone Clinical Studies supports WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, we'll hear from a young woman whose poem has gone viral. It's about how girls learn from their mothers to shrink themselves.
The burden of this house has followed me across the country. I asked 5 questions in genetics class today, and all of them started with the word sorry.
That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We are talking about our addiction, for some of us, to a faster and faster life and the impact of digital media, what it's doing to our brains and those of our children, with Stephanie Brown and Michael Rich. Michael, I'd like you to talk about your seatbelt theory.
Well, you know, what often happens when I will present our research to a group of parents or basically anybody, one of the responses is, you know, wait a minute, I grew up watching TV all the time and I'm just fine. Why are you concerned about this? And my response is really, I grew up in a time when there weren't seatbelts in every car. That doesn't mean that I haven't been able to use the knowledge that we have gained through science since then to put myself and my children in seatbelts. We are always learning. We are always getting better. And frankly, we often learn by making mistakes and correcting them. Our danger is that we will be so arrogant as not to learn from our mistakes.
Yeah. Yeah. That's of great concern. So, what is there to learn from our mistakes, and how can we begin to change?
Well, I think that what we have to realize is that we need to be conscious in what we choose to do, and particularly what we choose to teach and model for our children. And we have to constantly be evaluating that for the outcomes and whether these are the outcomes we want for them. I often say to folks that parenting is an art, not a science. And we are all going to do it differently, and we are all going to make mistakes. We will never be perfect at it. But that doesn't mean that we can't keep perfecting it. And particularly in the shifting electronic digital environment in which these folks are learning to raise their children, we need to constantly be aware. We need to constantly be checking in not only on our own outcomes, but what knowledge is out there to help inform our choices going forward. And that's what we're trying to do with research, trying to move it out of this realm of it's a bad thing, pornography is evil, so don't do it. It's not about pornography being evil. It's about how pornography may change us. And you can fill in the blank with 100 other things for pornography. So ultimately, that's what we're trying to do. And frankly, we're figuring this out together as we go along. And that's why I have this online advice column for parenting in the digital age called Ask the Mediatrician, where they do just that. They ask me questions, you know, that range from introducing cell phones to how do I get my kid to quit singing Viva Viagra in the supermarket. And we answer them with research in balanced ways and in ways that help us correct and redirect our parenting all the time.
I got to go off script here a minute, Michael. So how do you get your kid to stop singing Viva Viagra
in the supermarket? Yeah. Well, I can tell you what happened in this case. We gave the response to the mother and told her to talk to him about it. And I got an email about 3 weeks later saying, my 10-year-old says he'll never sing about broken penises again.
Okay, well, there you go. Stephanie, I'm sorry. I kind of interrupted you. You were about to say something.
I was going to make a different kind of comment there based on what Michael was saying about what we already know and what we don't know. We have not talked about child development, human development, founded on attachment to one another, the attachment of an infant to its mother, father, most important people, and that bond starts with an emotional base. We have moved in our day and age to devalue the depth of an emotional connection, believing again that everything exists in the contact. The family dinner is a fabulous next step, bringing the family together, but we need to add to our outline of the family dinner that we sit together and we talk, that we don't sit around the table with our tech gear in hand, exchanging texts and emails.
Yeah, that's what Michael.
We must learn to cultivate conversation again. Young people learn all about who they are, their identity, in their development through the interaction, the attachment, the bonding, the interaction with their parents that they then extend in their worlds to their peer group, growing up with an ability to talk in a reciprocal way. We have lost that, and really importantly, our belief system has devalued the necessity of going back and forth and letting our conversations and our thinking develop.
Yeah,
we want instant answers.
Yeah, well, it's like Michael said earlier in the show that we've become reactive and not reflective. Michael, I want to ask the mediatrician a question. And this is good. Now I'm back on script now. So, advice for parents. How can a parent monitor what their children are doing on screen time? How can they provide structure? I love what you said when we spoke with you earlier about not using the iPad as a reward for something. I never would have thought of that, to be honest.
Well, the moment you use it either as a reward or as a punishment in its omission, it becomes a forbidden fruit, and it becomes something that the child focuses on. And in fact, for this very reason, I recommend, and this is controversial, that parents not have, quote, screen time limits. Because when you set screen time limits, they will take that period of time, say 2 hours, and use it first, the first moment they have free when they come home from school. And at the end of those 2 hours, they will say, but I'm not finished this program, or I'm not through this level of the game, and you have a conflict at every turn, every single time you do this. Instead, I suggest that they flip that paradigm completely upside down and sit down with their child, and you can do this with the kids as young as even 4 or 5, and lay out their 24-hour day and fill the glass from the bottom up with hours of sleep, meal with family, homework, outside play, et cetera, and you see what time is left. You're doing several things here. First of all, you're teaching them to schedule themselves, teaching them to prioritize, teaching them to do something we all need help doing, which is time management. At the same time as you are modeling for them that media is not either a prize or a punishment, but is part of our lives and needs to be fit in where it is, where it fits in the order of importance.
I love that idea. I've got to tell you, can that really happen with somebody who's 4 or 5? I've got a little 5-year-old in my life who struggles with his mom and his Didi with his iPad issues. Can we do that with?
Look, it's never perfect, but what you do is you start teaching them early and you keep trying and you set that model for them that they can then follow. Kids aren't perfect at potty training first. They're not perfect at riding a bicycle. But if you set that as an expectation, the seatbelt is a good analogy for that too, which is that if you set as an expectation their seatbelt is always fastened before you start the car, it becomes part of them very quickly. And it actually works with very young children. I'm not saying they don't fight back, but what doesn't happen is it doesn't become the default activity.
Well, you know, I'm listening to the two of you over the course of our time together, and I gotta tell you, my anxiety is going up, and I'll tell you why. I've got a book coming out in March, and is anybody out there going to have the patience to read it?
On their e-readers.
as if I'm writing short chapters, like two paragraph yeah. chapters?
Right, haiku.
It all depends.
I am concerned about our attention span. Not just our young people, but our older people, too.
That's right.
Well, the publishing industry has really suffered.
yeah.
But it is, the publishing industry is still there. Publishing books, people are buying books. I see out here in Silicon Valley and through the country, I begin to see that point of people saying, hold on, what are we doing? And that's what we need. We need it to become trendy, to slow down, reflect, and then pick up the book again.
Well, to steal a page out of Stephanie's model, Michael, do you think we can hit bottom with this and wake up and say, my God?
I think that's going to happen, you know, as individuals. It happens for individuals. You know, all politics right. is local, and all parenting is local, too. And I think we just have to make that choice, just as parents make choices about the food they feed their children or the schools they send their kids to. They're going to have to make a choice. I think the real issue we have with parenting is that we are in a place where, first of all, we have many parents who want to be best friends with their children, so they never say no. They never give structure to their kids. And the second thing is that we do have a generational divide between digital natives and digital immigrants, and an awful lot of parents just check out from their kids' digital lives, and they need to be present and active in their kids' digital lives. As their kids start taking on more and more of an interaction with the outside world through these devices, the parent needs to be present there, just as the parent needs to be in the front seat of the car, white-knuckled, when the child drives for the first time.
Mm-hmm. I would like to hear both of your predictions over the next 10 years. We'll start with you, Stephanie. 10 years from now, what's your prediction, not your wish?
I have no idea, absolutely no idea of prediction. I can tell you what I hope for is that we will wake up, get that awareness I'm talking about, understand that parents need to be involved with setting limits and structure, but what we've abdicated is emotional and active engagement with one another. And I would like to see a return to the value of engagement. That means talking. Kids need their parents to look at them from the youngest age. And parents are looking away.
Yeah,
culture that avoids and looks away from a depth of interaction. So I will hope that we will come back to value the slowing down that it takes to look at one another again and become engaged interpersonally.
Well, thank you. What's your prediction, Michael? 10 years.
Well, I think we have to move past our illusion that connectedness equals connection. And I agree with Stephanie very much that we have to re-engage, not just with each other, but with ourselves. The other thing that is being lost in this whole constellation of reactivity that we're in is that we don't take a moment to reflect and to examine ourselves and to really think about, why am I doing this? What am I on this earth for? And I think that we're going to see people do that more and more as they just get fed up. Because, you know, to go back to something you spoke about early in the show about these kids competing for fewer and fewer spots in college, what I also see is when those kids get in those spots in college, they drink themselves stupid, mm-hmm. and they don't use that experience they worked hard for because they're so anxiety-ridden and so burnt out from the process of getting there that they don't experience it while they're there.
Yeah, I got to tell you, I recently went through your campus, not yours, but Harvard's campus.
And I don't own it yet.
I was... Keep hope alive, Michael. But I was struck by the looks on these kids' faces. There wasn't a lot of laughter going on there. I didn't even see a lot of interpersonal interaction. They didn't look like they were having fun. Now, that's just me riding through the streets, and I stopped at a Starbucks, but didn't look like a happy place to me.
Well, it's a very high-pressure place, yeah. And we all handle pressure differently.
Yeah, yeah. So I guess the bottom line here is we all have to take better care of our children and ourselves, and having the courage to take a step back, to do things differently, to have a family meal together. It's really an act of courage to say, I'm going to do something different tomorrow. And that is how we begin to change our lives and who knows, maybe the world. Stephanie Brown, Michael Rich, I want to thank you both so much. Both so much for joining us. It was a very, very important show. And thanks for the work you're both doing. Dr. Stephanie Brown is a psychologist specializing in addictions. She's written Speed, Facing Our Addictions to Faster and Faster. Michael Rich is Associate Professor of Pediatrics at Harvard. Next week, we're preempted. On January 27th, we'll be talking with Dan Siegel about the teenage brain. It should be a fascinating show. Well, listen to our podcast. We're at whyy.org/voices. Follow us at Twitter. We're at Voices in the Fam. And take a look at my new webpage. Love to hear what you think about it. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Luna is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our production assistant. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Gita Simons is our brand new producer. Gita, welcome to the hood. Great job today. Oh, I forgot who I was. I was Dan Gottlieb. I still am. Have a great week, my friends.